Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. Today's show feels like it's all about the stratosphere. At 9:30, we'll talk to two St. Mike's professors who are conducting research for NASA on virtual reality. At 10 o'clock, Bob Ney gives us a 10,000-foot view of what's happening in the world. That's followed by Jordan Adams of 7 Days talking about Burlington's sky tunnels. And then we hear from Alex Crothers of Higher Ground. But we might actually be saving the best for first today. We're going to learn about something called sky running. What's sky running? My definition is that it's a race with a view, but we'll learn more from our three guests. Joining me is a sky runner, Aaron McGill. Aaron, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello.
Hello there. John Kerrigan is one of the U.S. Youth Sky Runner National Coaches. John, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. And Ryan Kerrigan is also a coach for the national team. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Rick. Thank you so much for having us on this morning.
It's our pleasure. Listeners, to ask our guests about sky running and why anyone would do this, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ryan, what in the world is sky running?
Good question. Sky running is technical mountain running. It's more elevation, vertical focused than distance focused. It's a race director for a sky race. You would look at a given landscape or look at a mountain and think, what is the hardest thing a person could do on 2 feet on this mountain? And that's basically a sky race.
And how did this develop into a sport?
Well, there's a sky runner in all of us, and the earliest hunter-gatherers, we moved from the ocean into the mountains, peddling fares and getting away from enemies and so on. So just it's part of our DNA. It's part of who we are. And the modern version of that developed more from some of the most recent Italian mountaineers. Mm-hmm. And it became more of a speed-focused sport.
John Kerrigan, how did you first learn about sky running?
Well, it was through Ryan. We were Ryan came home after finishing up his camp that he had. He had a youth camp for kids and went over the summer. And he said it went really well, and he really liked the kids and wanted to do something special for them. So we said, well, what about a race somewhere? And he found this race in Andorra, which I had never heard of Andorra before, but it's a little country, yeah. Very much like Vermont, independent, in the Pyrenees Mountains between Spain and France. Yeah. And he emailed the meet director and said, yeah, come on over. And we didn't know what we were getting into. We became the national team.
Who was on the first national U.S. national world skyrunning team?
Well, we had 7 athletes.
Wow!
All were connected to Harwood. Well, one was from Middlebury High School, and they ranged in age from there about between 16 and 18, and they just did incredibly well for kids. Just these are kids that live in the mountains, and they met like-minded kids that live in the mountains in the Alps and Pyrenees and other places in Europe.
Mm. Now, Aaron, how and when did you learn about sky running?
I learned about sky running from the Kerrigans because I was doing the summer program that they did. We were mostly training for cross country, but they came up with the idea to go to these sky running championships. I thought, I like hiking, I like running. This sounds like somewhere between the two.
Well, now, Aaron, be honest. I mean, what did you think when you first heard about it? You know, were you really chuffed, or you were thinking, okay, the Kerrigans, this is too much?
I thought it was a little bit of a crazy idea to go all the way to Andorra for a race. But we really had no idea what we were getting into. We'd never done the sport before. It just sounded like something that could be interesting.
And Aaron, now you're one of the few people on Earth who can say that they've been to Andorra. So it really works out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Ryan, is there any comparable competitions to skyrunning?
As far within the U.S., or how do you mean?
Yeah, as a sport. I mean, you know, if someone, you know, says, well, I've seen this, you know, that's something like skyrunning.
Yeah, unfortunately, in the U.S., well, you know, for better or for worse, our legislation really protects the mountaintops. Mm. And so events over the tops of protected areas is not a popular subject around among parks and so on. There are places in the U.S. that are being able to do it with insurance policies and so on some level. But other sports in the U.S. would be Spartan races, mm-hmm. other adventure races, and so on. More kind of man-made, manufactured mountain fun. So, and those are great training tools and great races to get involved in skyrunning. Furthermore, the skyrunning terrain is there. You can go do it. You basically can't go out the door in Vermont without hitting a mountain. So,
this is true. And in the competition, is if am I correct, it's broken into two different types of runs, John?
Yes, there's a vertical kilometer, or what we call VK, and that's straight up the mountain. The meet directors, you don't really know the course too well until a day or two before, where they just go out and put little blue flags, and they go pretty much straight up the mountain, not necessarily on a trail, which, as Ryan said, would be difficult to do here. I mean, you could imagine going to the Green Mountain National Forest people and saying, you want to do what? You know. But that's the first event, and then there's that's on Friday, and then there's a day off, and then on Sunday, the kids will race the Sky Race, which is basically includes the vertical kilometer. You go back up the mountain again straight, but this time you also have to run along the ridges. And in Grand Sasso, there's five peaks that you have to go up and over. And this simulates what happened with the original Skyrunner, which was Ootsie, the Iceman they discovered in a glacier back in the 1990s, who they believe is 6,000 years old, and it was probably the first Skyrunner.
Ah, so Ryan wasn't kidding when he's saying this is really one of the first competitions or first sports anybody, any of us have ever competed in. John, back in the 60s, we were blown away by Olympic runners like Kip Kano of Kenya and others who trained at altitude. Is this the basic premise of skyrunning, and is it a technique that Vermonters can utilize to improve their distance running?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's not really so much about the altitude, or, you know, as Ryan has said, it's more about being in the elements.
Mm.
The championship races do have to be over 2,000 meters, and that's why we could never host a world championship in Vermont. But we could in Colorado or Utah. So, yeah, it is great training for any sport, really. We had, the first time we went, we had a kid who really wasn't a distance runner. He was a sprinter, a jumper, and he actually did quite well.
Wow.
We find the most compatible sport is Nordic skiing.
Mm.
But the most difficult thing to get used to is running down the hill.
Yeah.
Just about everybody can run up the hill, but it's running technically down the hill fast, which is very, very difficult. There's a lot of scrapes and bruises at the finish of a sky race.
That makes a lot of sense. I remember when I used to run the I didn't run the full marathon in Stowe, but, you know, on a relay team, and whoever got that leg coming down the mountain always had a pretty rough time of it. Yeah, Aaron, what is it that you enjoy about skyrunning?
I think my favorite part of skyrunning is that although there are other competitors in the race, it really feels like it's you versus the mountain.
Mm.
And the challenge is the course. It's so much harder than, say, a cross-country course or obviously a track. So it feels like you're challenging yourself. See how fast you can climb this mountain. Can you finish this 13-mile race that goes above 2,000 meters?
And because these courses, you know, aren't something you would have run before and aren't even determined till a couple days before the competition, how have you been able to train for competitions in the sport of skyrunning, Erin?
I train doing a mix of running on the roads here, trying to find the hilliest routes, and then a couple times a week going to the mountains, running on trails, trying to hike up as fast as I could. For the downhills, we usually train by running down ski areas because that's where you can get such a steep trail like you'll see in the race.
Wow. John Kerrigan, you're the coach of the Harwood Union cross-country team. Have you been using this kind of training for your team there at Harwood?
Well, yes. Well, we don't actually do sky running, but we have very hilly terrain. I mean, they call us the Highlanders for a reason.
Right.
I think running on hilly terrain prepares you for almost anything else you're going to see, any other cross-country course, in New England at least. And so, yeah, running uphill is definitely a good skill to have. And running downhill fast is also a good skill to have. So, yes, we kind of use some of the skyrunning techniques in cross-country.
Erin, when you've trained for skyrunning, how do you think that has helped you as a runner in other competitions?
Doing cross-country running in the fall after training for skyrunning in the summer,
mm-hmm.
Every hill feels not so steep compared to what we did in the sky races.
Yeah, I can believe that. And Ryan, tell us about, you know, when you first did this. You were the one who introduced John to skyrunning. So when you did your first sky run, what was that like? You know, what did you feel?
Well, honestly, I hadn't really witnessed a sky race until the kids did one in Andorra. I knew about the sport, and I just knew that through my time with Nordic Ski Racing, it was as challenging as it was and exciting as it was. Every year when the snow melted, it was kind of a relief to just be able to go back to the running shoe. And without, you know, the 10 pairs of skis and the wax support and all of that. So, and I knew that I wanted to get back involved or more involved with running again, but not in the way that I had previously with track and field and cross country. I wanted a more wild type of running. And we'd been coaching summer program with mostly the Harwood kids, and the kids improved throughout the years, and we're looking for new experiences for them and more challenging races. And the more we looked outside of Vermont within the U.S., the more it kind of took us to hot, flat places. And we were kind of purposefully training the kids out of the hills to do better at these higher caliber cross-country races and these flatter landscapes. And that just didn't sit right. The kids love having hills, running hills, and we have the access to that kind of terrain. And I thought, there must be a youth event somewhere that highlights that young hill junkie. And I saw that skyrunning was putting on a youth world championship in Andorra in 2017. And I thought, oh, well, this will be hilly.
Oh, well done, Ryan. We're going to take a call from Fred in Newbury. And if, Fred, you tell us that earlier in your life you were a sky runner, that's it. I will be forever impressed. What's up, Fred?
Well, I wasn't quite a sky runner, but I was a sky walker. Anyways, the all-time sky runner is a guy named Scott Lowley. And here's what Scott did. He ran 453 miles on the Oregon portion of the Pacific Trail. He ran a supported race, and it took him 8 days, 12 hours, and 5 minutes to do the 453 square miles in Oregon. He's the all-time winner of sky running or sky walking.
Very impressive. Thanks, Fred. Boy, and just doing the quick math, it sounds like he was running 55 to 60 miles a day. Wow. I'm really impressed. John, what kind of runners do you think should give sky running a go?
Anybody who likes to run and likes to be in the elements. and is up for the challenge. It doesn't have to necessarily be a cross-country runner. We had a track runner, one of the first times we went out to the World Championships. He was under 15 minutes, actually, in a cross-country 5K, which is in high school, which is extremely impressive.
Wow.
And it was his first time on a mountain. Ryan tells the story that he was previewing the course, and I think Aaron was there, they got about a quarter way up the mountain, and Noah looks down at the village, and he says, "Hey, guys, look down. Wow, the village looks so small." You know, he had never been on top of a mountain, and he actually didn't do as well as some of the people like Aaron's younger brother, Brendan, who's 5K times for nowhere near Noah's. Hmm. So it takes a person who loves to be in the element, loves to be in the hills. You never know what nature is going to throw at you. It's possible to start out in, you know, 30 degrees Celsius weather, and at the top of the mountain, you're, you know, below zero Celsius, and there's pelting snow and rain. So if you like the challenge and you like surprise, you'd like skyrunning.
Oh, my. Hey, Ryan, who is on the junior team that's headed to Italy?
We have 8 individuals this year. We have 3 from Vermont, including Naya Tower Pierce and her brother Finn Tower Pierce, another boy from the Middlebury area, Will Haig, and we have a girl from California, Elliot. I'm blanking on her last name now.
All right.
And just pulling up my list here. Maybe if you can move to another question.
Well,
for
we
a
have
moment.
Noelle Spencer from Alaska.
Hmm.
And Alaska,
yes,
seems to be a real hotbed for skyrunning.
Understandably.
It's very well accepted there, and the runners we've had from Alaska have been well funded by local communities and local merchants, because it's very popular.
We also have
Alaska.
Jacob Eggert from Salt Lake City.
All right.
Wendell Lorenzen from Washington State. And, yeah, as we mentioned, Noel O'Park Chapin from Oregon as well.
All right. So Vermont and the West Coast really well represented in skyrunning. And didn't we just have a team from the U.S. Over in Spain? Now, that would have been, I don't know if you call it the senior team, but the U.S. team in Spain for championships there?
Yes, we did. We had a handful of folks that were able to squeak in under the COVID protocols and get there and represent.
All right. And how'd they do over there?
They did fantastic. We had one woman who was fit, just coming off of an injury.
Wow.
And we had another 2 top 10 finishes as well.
Mm, congratulations.
Yeah,
all
one
right.
Of the best, one of the best skyrunners in the world is actually a Vermonter, Hillary Girardi, who's from the St. Jay area, and she's now living in France.
Oh, my.
Aaron got to meet her in Andorra. She had raced, and she just won the Monte Rosa, Ryan, is that right? One of the biggest sky races in
yes,
the world.
She just won a big race in Italy.
Mm. Aaron, we've all heard of the runner's high, but what is it like when you reach a summit and take in some of the beautiful vistas when you're running, when you're doing the sky running?
It's completely amazing.
Hmm.
When you get to the top of the mountain and you look down and you realize that you just climbed in an hour in a race what you would ordinarily consider an entire day's worth of hiking, you feel so accomplished.
And do you think that, you know, you'll come back to skyrunning at different points in your life, that this is something you'll pursue throughout your life?
Definitely. I'm running college cross country right now, but I'm hoping that after I graduate, I can come back to more skyrunning, mountain running, anything on trails.
That's great. Where are you going to school, Aaron?
Brandeis University.
Oh, fantastic. That's great. All right, so, John, I know you're not out there, you know, looking for the next grueling sport to test those Harwood Highlanders, but, you know, because that you mentioned their name, the Highlanders, do you feel that, you know, getting them to run up those mountaintops along ridges is an advantage, you know, when you're racing against other high schools around the state?
Oh, yeah, not just around the state, because, you know, most Vermonters race on hills.
Yeah.
But especially when we go to regional competition for the New Englands and so on. We went to a race in Maine, and Aaron was there a few years ago, and we were previewing the course, and there was supposed to be a hill in the course, and we stopped, and we said, I asked one of the other coaches, I said, where's the hill? He said, oh, you just went over it. So every other course, as Aaron says, when you're sky racing, you're on the steepest hills in the world.
Yeah.
There's nothing that we run in as a cross-country team that compares to that.
Fantastic. Aaron McGill is the sky runner. Ryan and John Kerrigan are the coaches of the U.S. national team headed to the Youth Sky Running World Championships in Italy. Thank you all for being on the program today, and best of luck.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care.
Thanks for having us.
All right, take care now. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back to talk with two St. Michael's College professors doing research on virtual reality and stress. And tonight on WDEV, we've got Game 2 of the Red Sox-Yankees series from Fenway. A wild, wonderful win last night. Our coverage tonight begins at 6:10, game getting started at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sangari. Our next segment involves NASA, stress, virtual reality, and two St. Michael's professors. It almost sounds like the premise for a new Netflix series set in the not-too-distant future, but instead it involves research currently being conducted at St. Mike's that could benefit our space program. Here to discuss the project are the two researchers working on it. Melissa Vanderkay-Tomasulo is a professor of psychology at St. Mike's. Melissa, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for asking, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great having you. And Dagan Loisel is a professor of biology at St. Mike's. Dagan, great to have you here as well.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
All right. Now, listen, listeners, to ask our guests a question about the research they're conducting, you can give us a call, 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Melissa, explain what the research project is that the two of you are working on.
So we are working on a project that will hopefully have a good application here on Earth, but primarily for NASA. So we are looking at ways to improve the immune health of astronauts, whether they're on the International Space Station or hopefully on our way to the Moon and Mars in future missions. And one way to improve the immune system is to reduce stress. So a space flight is very stressful, as well as our astronauts are trained. It's a hostile environment, and we are looking for ways to reduce stress through a virtual reality protocol and then hopefully offset the immune dysregulation that occurs due to stress being a factor.
Dagan, where did the idea for this project come from, and when did you start working on it?
Well, that's actually a great question. Melissa and I taught a Intro to Health Science course together, and we were discussing this link between stress, for example, academic stress or the stress of deep space missions, and what it does to the body. And our students were like really interested in it. And so we started talking because it actually took it came from both of our areas of expertise. And we realized, hey, we could do something like this. And so we got in contact with our local NASA folks and then our collaborators at NASA and developed this project. A couple years ago, we started working on this.
So I wondered why that combination of psychology and biology professors working together on this made sense. So it a great outgrowth of a class that you taught together. Melissa, so what are you studying from the psychology point of view during this research?
Yeah, excellent question. So certainly psychological stress would be the main premise here. But there's also tremendous research that not a lot of people are aware of, that psychological stress really affects the physical body as well. It can lead to, if there's a lot of stress that one experiences that is not regulated, so we're looking at chronic stress, it can make you more susceptible to illness. It can make you more likely to have subclinical reactions to any latent virus that you've been exposed to, for example, Epstein-Barr virus. And so really where my part comes into is really looking at stress reduction and how, if we reduce stress, maybe that can prevent immune issues later on.
All right. And Dagan, I think Melissa answered some of it, but what are you looking at from the biology perspective in this project?
Yeah, so biologically, we're looking at a few different indicators or markers. We call them biomarkers of stress in the body. And so, for example, cortisol levels, which can then dramatically impact the way our immune system is working. Our immune system is usually like this finely tuned set of feedbacks. Well, when you throw a big stressor on there, it can throw the whole system out of whack. And so we're looking at these indicators of stress. And so we have a couple immunological ones. So we can look directly at the immune molecules and see, you know, is there a whole bunch more of it or less of it? Is it in the wrong place? And then, as Melissa mentioned, we can look at the output. When our immune systems aren't working well, viruses tend to do really well replicating in there. So we look directly at the viruses, for example, in saliva and urine in our participants.
And so, you know, stress is definitely, you know, the issue here, what you two want to look at. Dagan, why, though, was virtual reality the mechanism you decided on using for this research? You could have researched in any of a number of different ways. Why VR?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So specifically, we're interested in how VR meditation, and especially guided meditation for those who aren't really, you know, adept or experienced with meditation. And the VR part was there because when we actually thought about it and talked with folks at NASA, including astronauts, they talked about missing the images of Earth. Mm. And so one of the things the VR does, it allows us to create this whole visual experience in addition to the meditation. And that way, maybe it will sort of enhance the effects of the meditation on reducing stress, or give comfort to, for example, astronauts or people who are doing research in Antarctica who are stuck seeing the same scenes.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Melissa, now you recruited students from the student body first and then later from the St. Mike's Fire and Rescue Squad. And just a shout out to that squad because one of the few colleges in the country that have their own fire and rescue squad. But I'm going to ask you, why recruit, you know, the students from the student body and then later from that fire and rescue squad?
Yeah, thank you for the shout out. Those students are working really hard at Fire and Rescue. So we wanted to just start with opening up to the general student population last fall. And, you know, the pandemic was, it's still ongoing, of course, but we just wanted to invite any student that was interested in stress reduction during that time. And then we refined our protocol, and we really wanted to give back to our first responder units here. And so we thought we would tailor our study a little bit more to helping our first responders during a pandemic to reduce their stress. And so we, and of course, they're research students as well. Many of them are in the biology department and had an interest in the field.
Now, Dagan, you talked a little bit about this, but explain the actual testing that the students are being put through with the virtual reality.
Yeah, and so for the virtual reality meditation, we basically asked them to do 20-minute meditations four times a week. And we had, for the second part of the study, we had a couple different time periods. So one group was doing it over 4 weeks. So basically 4 weeks of meditations, and then another group was doing 8 weeks. So we could see if there was a difference there. And then we asked them to sort of record their experience in there. And they also do these weekly surveys that give us an indicator of how they're perceiving their own stress. And then we would also collect biosamples every week from them, so that way we can look at those physiological, those body markers that we were talking about earlier. And so that was kind of the most basic part of what we're doing, plus a bunch of little offshoots here and there.
Now, when you use virtual reality, are they seeing images, experiencing something through the VR?
Yeah, so we actually were working with a company called Trip, and they were actually developing these really interesting, highly visual and meditations that had a sort of backdrop of different scenery, and it changed every day. And that way the students weren't looking at the same VR meditation and same background all the time, so it was constantly changing. And then recently they've actually modified the app for the VR headset, so now you can actually design more of the scene you're interested in.
Melissa, you're working with NASA on this. Now, how closely are they involved in the research project that you're conducting?
Excellent question. So we are working very closely. We consider ourselves mutually collaborators. So we are working with the Johnson Space Center NASA Virology Immunology Lab that's led by Dr. Brian Krushian and Dr. Satish Mehta. And we have been having regular telecons with them and really being there, you know, letting us decide what protocol we feel is best, but we are working jointly with them. And they are analyzing all of our biological samples for us because they have tremendous interest in this as well.
Now, Dag and Melissa earlier talked about, you know, why NASA is involved and what they would use this for. Do you see any other practical applications from the research that you're doing here?
Yes. You know, we see a lot of applications. For example, with our students, you know, a lot of them were experience academic stress, so that's one area. But when you think about all the different people out there doing different things, for example, scientists working at a research station far away, people who are doing any sort of activity where they're separated from their sort of normal experience, we think this would be applicable for that, giving them sort of a stress-relieving protocol that they could do basically from anywhere and without much space.
And Melissa, having conducted this research during the oddest and most stressful time in most of our lifetime, has that affected the results?
That's a great question. And certainly when we designed this project, we had submitted our first grant proposal in early March of 2020, and we had no idea what this was going to mean with the pandemic. And we don't have the results, the biological results yet, but anecdotally, students were telling us, those general students as well as our first responder students, that they were finding the VR protocol to reduce stress for them. So we're still waiting to see the impact on the physical body and on those biomarkers, but anecdotal evidence and to just know that we were helping students was pretty impactful for us.
Wow. So you had a positive impact at the most stressful time in these students' lives that probably any college student will go through now.
Yeah, for sure. Again, we're looking for that data, and we should have the early data soon at the end of the month to see how it matches. But, you know, students are finding, you know, they were, of course, not astronauts, but they were experiencing more confinement that they would have liked. Right. They weren't able to see their family. They weren't able to go home on the weekends due to quarantine protocols and so forth. And so not the same, but was certainly not just academic stress. There was a lot more going on.
Some definite parallels. So, wow, that really is interesting. I'm going to ask you both this question, starting with you, Dagan, looking at biological results, and Melissa, you looking at psychological results. Now, you say the results aren't in, but are your results, you know, in a vacuum, or how do you see the two results, the two sides, being able to be kind of cross-indexed? So, in other words, Dagan, you know, not just your biological results, but how do you see, you know, the results coming from Melissa's side, the psychological results, working together with yours?
Yeah. So the sort of the big thing that we want to emphasize is that this is all integrated. You know, we like to think of it as one big system with inputs. and the psychological stressors really are inputs. They will then, you know, affect things like sleep. They will affect motivation. They will affect, you know, your ability to do the things that are good for you and maybe overindulge in the things that are bad for you. And then we can see the direct consequences on behavior, on the endocrine system, on the immune system. And so we look at it as like a series of inputs that then hit some of the consequences. And so it's all connected. And so what we'd like to do is be able to show on multiple different levels the effects of stress and the effects of mitigating or reducing that stress with the VR meditation.
Mm. Melissa, what would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I think Dagan answered that very clearly, but I will also add, we had all of our participants in the spring study, so our first responders, we had given them a Fitbit activity tracker and sleep tracker to wear as well. So they wore that for the entire 10-week duration of the study. So we're looking at that data as well, and that will tell us how was their sleep affected. For example, how much sleep were they getting each night, but what did that sleep look like? We call that sleep architecture. So was your slow wave sleep, that deep resting sleep, affected by your stress levels? What was the impact on REM sleep when you're dreaming? And also looking at the activity levels. Were people less likely to engage in exercise? Were they exercising more? And so those are also behavioral indices of psychological stress that also, as you can imagine, have a profound impact on the physical body. So stress, when you exercise, that reduces stress. Does that then have a positive impact on the immune system? We hope so. So looking at all those behavioral indices and matching them, as Dagan mentioned, that integrated approach is really effective, and we're looking forward to those results.
We only have a few minutes left, but let's try to get in a call. Stuart is joining us from Worcester. Hi, Stuart. Go right ahead.
Hi. This is pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you're using for a control. In other words, would you have a subject just sit restfully and meditate without a visual stimulus and compare the results to what you have with the VR?
Stuart, thanks for that question. Who'd like to answer that?
Whoever can.
Okay.
I'm happy to answer that.
Right,
hi, Melissa. Stuart. Thanks for your question. So interestingly, you know, Dagan mentioned that our study had a 4-week VR meditation, and then we had an 8-week integration protocol for that. So the participants in the 4-week, they started later. So they were, in a sense, a control. The control meaning no VR and our experimental condition being the VR. But it's an interesting question because where we're moving into research this year, so we have funding again for the next cycle, is we want to get at that. And we're developing that now. So we're going to be testing people while they are meditating. You know, what are they? Should they be using VR to meditate? Would a regular meditation protocol be effective as well? And maybe bringing in some meditation protocols using the OVR technology, which is using olfactory VR, that we're also exploring. So it's an excellent question, and we don't want to see necessarily which is best, but we want to know, are they individually effective? Because astronauts, if you think about it, and you're on a long mission, a 3-year mission to Mars, you're going to want variety. You're going to get bored with regular meditation. You perhaps could get bored with the regular VR meditation. So you want a lot of variety for those explorers.
Oh, that's great. Stuart, excellent question. Thanks so much. Dagan, as the research went on and you were talking to the students who were subjects in this, what kind of feedback were you getting and what kind of feedback surprised you that you heard from them?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. We actually, you know, anecdotally, we had really positive feedback from the majority of the participants. You know, it was a very stressful time, and in the spring project, we were working with the first responders, and they're responding to literally hundreds of fire rescue calls. They're trying to do their schoolwork. Some of them were getting ready to graduate, and several of them told me that it was a really nice sort of distraction. It was a really nice different thing that they got to do, speaking about the VR meditation, that sort of gave them sort of this different experience, and they just, you know, the app we were using was called Trip, and it is kind of trippy. It's kind of psychedelic and really out there. And so most of them really enjoy that, like, sort of weird psychedelic meditation feeling. Occasionally, though, and this is normal, right? Not everyone responds exactly the same way. So occasionally we'd have a participant who just would basically say, like, I don't really get it. And that's okay, because, again, everyone's different. Everyone's going to respond differently to the stimuli.
Wow. All right. That is Dagan Loisel, professor of biology at St. Mike's, also speaking with Melissa Vanderkay Tomasulo, a professor of psychology at St. Michael's College. I want to thank both of you for sharing your research with us. Really interesting stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. And continue with your research. Good luck with it. Thank you. We've got the top of the hour CBS News coming up next, and then we're going to be back to hear what's going on around the world and around the country from national correspondent Bob Ney. And coming up this afternoon, it's Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers. That's followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV, and we have national correspondent Bob Ney joining us today to provide an update on what's happening in the world. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Bob, let's start off with looking at the rising COVID numbers.
Well, you know, Rick, for a while, and you're always so good about every time we talk about the numbers. I think they're important. Yep. And there for a while, we were talking about how they were, you know, definitely on the lowering side. But unfortunately, today, they're not. The new cases rose. Now, the total deaths are 610,000, by the way, in the United States, 4 million some worldwide. Mm-hmm. But the new COVID-19 cases rose to about 27,000 per day. That's over the last week in the United States since we talked last. And so the experts are warning that there's, you know, the Delta variant, other variants. We could have a surge in cases. There are three states which also make up 40% of the new cases, being Missouri and Florida and Arkansas, so just in those three states. So overall, the number of new cases in the United States was listed at 224,953 for the week that ended Sunday. That is a 62% increase from when we last talked.
Wow. And, Bob, you'd think those kind of numbers would certainly get people back out to get vaccinated if they haven't already, but the vaccination rate seems to be falling as well. How do we turn that around?
Well, it is. You know, I was quoting your state on, you know, I do five other states radio, mm-hmm. and I was quoting, you know, your great state on, you know, stepping up to the plate. What is it, 82%?
83.2 right now.
There you go, 83.2. And if all the states did that, these numbers would be way far less than what we're talking about now. I'm not sure. I live on the border area of West Virginia. I saw Governor Justice down there. They're giving away guns. They're giving away, you know, raffles. If you get shots, Ohio went into a lottery, $5 million worth of lottery prizes, you know, for vaccinations. I don't know what works. I think maybe neighbor talking to neighbor, people who have had the shots. But unfortunately, probably, Rick, it's going to take increase in hospitalizations, a sort of semi-panic again to get more people. And I hate to say that, but that's probably what's going to happen. Also, I think with the CDC doing the honor system, you know, a couple months ago where, well, if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear your mask. All of a sudden, everybody was vaccinated,
right,
where I went, you know.
Because 100%. Everybody took off the mask.
The masks, yeah. Yes.
Indeed. Okay. I don't know what it will take. I did read a piece in the Boston Globe said that a lot of the lottery ideas and the giveaways have really had minimal effect, and the most important thing is for people to hear from their elected leaders, especially of their particular party, to send the message, and let's hope that happens. Let's move on to the infrastructure bill, Bob. Where are we with this right now?
Well, there was a vote, and Senator Schumer, the leader of the Senate on Democratic side, they lost the cloture vote. That's the famous, you know, anti-filibuster vote where you can get 60 votes and you take something to the floor. Well, he was trying to, you know, get votes, and he lost on getting 50 votes to bring a bill up just to be considered, the infrastructure bill. He lost. So he voted against his own measure because that legally allows him in the Senate rules to bring it up again. So sometimes people do that. They make a motion, they see it's going to lose, they vote against it, and if you're on the side that didn't prevail, you could bring it up again. So it was more of a tactic of Senator Schumer, Rick. I think he's saying, okay, y'all have a deal close, let's do it. And so he was making his point, you know, about trying to get the bill going. I would hope there'd be an infrastructure bill because, look, we are almost into August, and if the Senate can't, in 1 year, at least get an infrastructure bill, it's going to be a political problem for them.
Exactly. Bob, to put it in hockey terms, the infrastructure bill is basically the bipartisan empty net goal. So what does it say if we can't get this done?
Well, it's going to be an argument then of, you know, the Republicans saying, you see, it's the do-nothing Democrat-controlled Senate. You gave them power, and look what's happened to them. And on the other side, the Democrats are going to say, you know, this is the obstructionist Republican side to how the Senate runs. So, I mean, I think that's kind of a wash. So individually, it's going to be, you know, people running in their states and saying, you know, their side of it and what happened. Unfortunately for public policy, it means that, you know, probably there'll be general frustration with the Senate as a whole because it can't even get an infrastructure bill done. When I served, Rick, in Congress, I went through two infrastructure bills. I was a member of the Transportation Committee. This was the kumbaya, you know, hold hands, you're all one country, one party when it comes to infrastructure. They pass with ease, not now, which is sad.
Well, let's talk about something a little more contentious. The Congressional Committee on the January 6th insurrection, this definitely is a little bit more of a pitched battle.
This one is taking a turn that seriously shocked me. When I was in Congress, I chaired the House Administration Committee. My direct boss was the Speaker, Hastert, at the time, and my ranking member was Steny Hoyer, who directly reported to Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader. And then, you know, I had other ranking members when Steny moved on to other positions. But I went through that whole spiel, Rick, because this is how the system works when it comes to the Capitol Hill police. And so I'm watching this unfold. Number one, I'm shocked. You know, Nancy Pelosi did not get where she is being Speaker twice because she's not politically bright. No matter what anybody thinks of how Nancy Pelosi is philosophically, whether they like her or not, she has made the right political moves to be Speaker twice. I'm shocked of this move where she says, I don't like those members you're going to appoint. This kind of breaks, not kind of, this breaks congressional, you know, let's say, protocol. Even though she can legally do this, I'm shocked she did it. She's now made a secondary issue for the Republicans. Number two, when CNN fact-checked Congressman Jordan and said, well, the Speaker's not responsible for security, that's not accurate. I served there. I worked for the Speaker on the security issues. It does function from the Speaker to the Chair of House Administration. On the other side of it, if the Republicans attack her too much, they're also responsible. Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, is responsible for working for the security, too. So I think what they have done, they collectively, this whole thing's blown up. I don't think the commission goes anywhere. Yes, they'll have the hearings. bad move to have one person try to have the final rule on who all serves on the committee. The Republicans should appoint and the Democrats should appoint.
Gotcha. All right, Bob, let's talk about, we'll go foreign affairs and what's happening in Afghanistan. Looks like the Taliban really trying to make a move to take over the government there.
Well, yes, they are. And their statement is just fascinating. The Taliban, they say, well, they don't want to monopolize power, but they want the president, Ashraf Ghani, to be removed. Now, on the other hand, President Ashraf Ghani not only has trouble from the Taliban, he has trouble from others within his government because he basically is overstaying, which they are saying is, you know, him trying to control with power. So the Taliban, they see a weakness in the president's position, and they say, you know, well, we're not going to negotiate till he leaves. I see nothing good coming out of this. The Taliban, I was in Afghanistan twice. The things they did to people, the things they did to women are beyond unconscionable acts. And they're just trying to work around to where they control the government. Most likely they will not do what was done to us with the 911 because we invaded. They'll probably just tend to, you know, keep their terrorism internal and to keep their power internal. I can't imagine that this is going to come out good.
Oh, my. The people of Afghanistan deserve much better.
Terrible.
Yeah.
It's sad.
National correspondent Bob Ney, hey, thanks for helping us make sense of what's happening in the country and the world.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. I've seen them in Minneapolis when I visited there, and we're hearing the replacements from Minneapolis singing Skyway. These walkways, two or three stories up, that connect buildings, protecting pedestrians from the cold. But in Burlington, Vermont, apparently I just haven't been paying attention, according to a story by 7 Days music editor Jordan Adams, and he joins us to explain right now. Jordan, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great having you. Hey, before we go topside, let's start subterranean. What kind of underground tunnels do we have in Burlington?
From what I understand, there are quite a few. Just a couple years ago, some guys were doing some work right on my corner. I live in downtown Burlington, and they had uncovered an old sewer tunnel that they did not know would be there when they were digging in the ground. So there are sewer tunnels, there's old rail tunnels, there's this legendary network of bootlegging tunnels, of which I don't know how much is legend and how much is true. Yes, there are quite a few under Burlington.
All right. So I can't say that I've ever noticed the above ground sky tunnels. Am I that oblivious, Jordan?
Yes, you are.
Good answer.
it's really funny. You know, I had been I'm the kind of person who does sort of take notice of everything that's weird and strange around me, probably because I am one of those weird and strange things, I guess. I was sitting out in front of the archives on College Street with a 7 Days colleague, and I mentioned that I wanted to write this story, and we're sitting right across from one of these tunnels, and I pointed at it, and she said, "Wow, I've never noticed that before." And that would be the trend as I investigated these elevated walkways.
Oh, well, I'm in some good company then. I feel a little bit better. Are there a lot of these walkways in Burlington?
No, not a lot. There are really only a few, but they're all kind of clustered right in the same area. There's also one in the south end that connects some buildings in the arts district that I didn't check out for the story because I was sort of more interested in the ones that were like right in this little downtown cluster right around church and college.
All right. I'm trying to think of the one in the south end, and I still can't picture that one either. Now, the ones that we have, where are they, and do they rival what I observed in Minneapolis?
Not even close. No, they're very missable, so it's perfectly understandable that people wouldn't have noticed them, especially because two of them are on alley streets that, you know, most folks maybe aren't walking down. So one of them, however, is fairly prominently placed on College Street. It connects two of the buildings, the one on the northeast corner of Church and College, and then the building directly east of it. And then there's one over Thorson Way, which is the alley, the sort of elbow-shaped alley that connects Church and College up by Red Square past the Thai restaurant. And then the third one is there's an even tinier alley that juts behind Ake's Place right off of Thorson Way. It's sort of kind of slanted, connecting two of the buildings in a large complex that faces College Street.
Okay. That one I think I might be excused for not knowing because I don't think I've ever been back there. But
yeah,
the other
and it doesn't look – you can't necessarily tell that it is a tunnel for just by looking at it. You kind of have to, like, have the aerial above shot to
gotcha.
Really see that.
All right. Yeah. So how much use do the Burlington Sky Tunnels – and that's a great name possibly for a band, the Burlington Sky Tunnels – how much use do they actually get?
Not any, as far as I know.
At least
the College Street one and the one over Thorson Way. It was inconclusive what's going on with that third one. I was told by the property manager that it certainly is closed up on both ends. But when I went over to sort of take a look at it myself, I could see that there was a ceiling light on and a table pushed up against the window, and it looked inhabited. But again, the property owner could not verify that for me, which was unusual. But that's sort of, you know, part of the fun of WTF is finding out all the weird and strange things about Vermont.
Didn't you have one property owner not realize they had a sky tunnel?
Yes. yes. One of the property owners had no idea what I was talking about. In real time, had one of their assistants go out onto the street or look out a window and check for them. And that was pretty funny. But, you know, that's the thing is that the one on College Street, it is closed up on both ends. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of just this suspended remnant just hanging there above this teeny little alley. And the other one over Thorson Way, that one we know a little bit more about. And we can talk about that if you'd like.
Yeah, please do.
Mm-hmm. So that one definitely had a concrete purpose for a long time. It connected the old Burlington Free Press offices to its printing facility on South Winooski. And it was it is still accessible from the printing facility side. I have been invited to go take a look, which I might do, although it's not clear how safe or structurally sound it might be. So I might just kind of stand in the doorway.
And you can take me. Go ahead, Rick. You go first. You go check it out there.
Yeah, exactly. I'm right behind you. And so the Handy family, you know, the property owner, mm-hmm. you know, own many, many properties in Burlington. They purchased the old printing facility on, I think it's 127 South Winooski. They don't know what they're doing with that building yet. They just bought it in December. The tunnel will certainly never be actively used again. But, you know, it might just get sealed up and just kind of hang there, which is, you know, a pretty funny thing in my opinion, just to have these, like I said before, like remnants of, you know, the past just kind of suspended in air in downtown.
So you haven't been up in any of these skyways yet, is what you're telling us.
Sadly, no. And that was sometimes, you know, I'll let you in on a little secret. Sometimes we write stories because we have like a personal interest in them. And my ulterior motive for writing this story was to go inside all these tunnels. That's like my main objective.
Yeah, and you know, no one faults you for that, Jordan. That is absolutely what should have been your goal, and I agree with it.
Yeah, yeah. I had some great help from Vermont's state architectural historian Devin Coleman. He pulled up some historical maps from the Sanborn Map Company. They made these fire insurance maps in the 20th century and the 19th century, sort of showing these detailed schematics sort of buildings in urban areas. And in the 1894 Sanborn map, it shows that that third tunnel, the one that we don't know exactly what's going on with it, it's marked as the Slated Pass, and it was also used by the Burlington Free Press to connect an older printing facility that was on College Street to some other buildings that had a book bindery and some other facilities in it.
Are these old, these sky tunnels? Have they been around for a while?
That one is. The other ones, not as much. And so the College Street one does not appear on the 1942 maps, but it does appear on the 1950 map. So it must have been built between those two dates. And then there aren't any Sanborn Fire maps after 1950 for downtown Burlington. But Devin, the state architectural historian, mm-hmm. believes that the one over Thorson Way, due to its design and composition, was likely put in the 60s.
How can something like this, which you and I consider incredible works of architecture, be created and then just ignored?
You know, that's a great question, and that was one that I was unfortunately not able to answer. My main question was, if they're not in use, why weren't they torn down?
Yeah.
But that, you know, that was sort of one that's just kind of lingering out there now, unfortunately.
Now, go ahead.
I think it's neat that they're just sort of there, and I don't think they necessarily need to be torn down if they're not creating any problems.
I agree. And the real estate market is so tight in Burlington, and here are these what potential apartments sitting in empty in the sky. So any possibility that we can get them developed and then you can get a finder's fee?
Yeah, I mean, they'd be pretty small as apartments, but then again, I've looked at some pretty small apartments in Burlington, so it's maybe not that much of a stretch.
All right. Now, the next thing I want to know, I hope you're a Seinfeld fan, are you considering starting your version of the Kramer bus tour and drive people around, maybe on Segways, around downtown on the Jordan Adams Sky Tunnel Tour?
I had not thought about this, but if I do, I will steal your idea and take all of the credit.
You can feed them pizza bagels, and then for dessert, the mini Snickers, right?
Candy bars, right?
Right, the bite-sized candy bars. Oh, man, that's fantastic. And I should mention, I didn't say this at the start. You mentioned this was in the WTF column, which is the Whiskey Tango Foxtrot column. Somebody usually finds something in and around Vermont and says, you know, what is this thing? And you go out and find it. But this one you discovered yourself. Well, Jordan, what else are you working on? What else is out there that is so fascinating and captivating that you're going to have to write about soon?
I'm not sure. I don't have any other WTF columns in the works, but in the past, you know, so like you said, they usually do come from readers, but most of the times when I have taken on the column, they have been things that I've personally been interested in investigating, and things that, like, you know, I've heard people talk about or things that catch my eye. I actually recently stepped out of the music editor role, and I am now an arts and culture staff writer. So I'll be doing a lot more of that kind of stuff. And, I love quirky, anything quirky, and subcultury. So I'll be looking into a lot of that kind of stuff and writing about a lot of general arts and culture topics, and that, probably taking on WTF.
That makes me very happy. You can read Jordan Adams' story in this week's 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Jordan, thanks for being on with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News and then check in with what's happening at Higher Ground these days. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Yeah, 2020 was the year we all want to forget, and most of us weren't running a venue with live music performances. For those who were, well, thank goodness for 2021. And how great does it feel to once again be able to cruise highergroundmusic.com and check out all the upcoming shows? What a great thing to say again. To see who you need to see. Patty Griffin, Modest Mouse, The Psych Furs, Grace Potter, John Hyatt, Richard Thompson, Melissa Ferrick. It goes on and on. They're not all shows at Higher Ground, but some are shows presented by Higher Ground. It's time to talk about how they line up so many of those shows, and we're going to talk with Alex Crothers, founder of Higher Ground. Alex, so great to have you on the show this morning. Thanks for being here.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks, Rick.
Listeners, if you've got a question for Alex or if you want to tell us about a Higher Ground show that you remember well, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Alex, when did you start Higher Ground?
I started Higher Ground in April of 1998, April 15th, 1998, over in Winooski, Vermont.
So that location there in that strip mall was the first place you were doing shows with Higher Ground?
It was, yeah. So that was the first place that Higher Ground sort of was born. And we were there for 6 years in an inauspicious location. It was an old Denny's restaurant in a strip mall in downtown Winooski. And for those who remember Winooski in those days, Winooski was basically just one big flat surface lot. With two kind of dinky strip malls there with almost nothing happening in the strip malls. I think it was us and a Little Caesars were the only two businesses that were active in the storefronts. Everything else was boarded up.
Wow. Do you remember what your first Higher Ground show was, the first one you presented?
I do. It's like my child. The first show on April 15th was a co-bill with a band called Everything, which was kind of a funk party band out of Virginia, and another band out of Virginia called Agents of Good Roots.
Oh, wow. All right. So you said 6 years later, you moved to South Burlington. So what precipitated that move?
Winooski was undergoing an urban redevelopment project, which is, you know, effectively the Winooski you see today. And so that project started 3 or 4 years after we had launched there. And, you know, for all the reasons I just described, right? I mean, Winooski was basically just a just a surface lot downtown. It was a couple of strip malls with nothing going on. So there was a desire and an intention to redevelop it in the vision of what is there now. And so, you know, we were effectively one of the only viable businesses still there. So it became a bit of a David and Goliath story where, you know, we were finally, you know, 3 or 4 years in, we had gained some footing. We were financially stable for the first time. You know, we kind of hit a groove in terms of booking and promotions and audience. And, you know, so for us at the moment when they came and they said, you know, listen, you know, we're going to bulldoze all this down. It doesn't matter what's in your lease. You got to get out of here. Yeah. You know, it was terrifying and heartbreaking. So, you know, we had a couple of years of sort of fighting this fight against the developers and the city at the moment, saying, listen, like, you know, we came here, we took a chance, you took a chance on us, it's going well, you know, and now you're kicking us to the curb. We eventually reached a settlement that was fine and fair, but that precipitated the change. So like, okay, what's next? And we weren't totally sure we were going to go into the next phase. You know, we'd had a good 6 year run there. It was a lot of work. There were a lot of good times, great shows, you know, just memorable experiences. But, you know, from a financial standpoint, it wasn't, you know, none of us were paying the bills and certainly very few of us were even getting paid. So, you know, it was a hard decision, but we kind of wanted to keep going, and we landed on the location in Williston Road in South Burlington, where we are now, which was an old five-screen movie theater, that the folks who owned it were taking it off the market because there were too many screens in the market. And the Williston movie theater had just opened, the big megaplex out in Williston. So they needed to reduce the number of screens in the market. And so we looked at it, and we got really excited about the fact that it had that we could turn it into a space that had two different rooms, a larger ballroom, a smaller showcase room that could all be kind of run simultaneously. And that we opened on December 4th, 2004.
That sounds about right. Boy, I didn't know that Higher Ground was that close to saying, yeah, maybe this is the end of our run. And that would have been a sad thing for our area. Well, in South Burlington, in a normal non-COVID year, Alex, how many shows will you put on there?
The South of Burlington location will do almost 300 shows in a year between the two rooms. It fluctuates between 270 and 300. You know, one of the things that's interesting about our business is, you know, we don't control the inventory. You know, bands tour when they want to tour. Yeah. You know, in some years there are more bands touring than others. I mean, because we mostly focus on national touring artists that are, you know, going from city to city around the country. We obviously pepper in, you know, as much local and regional stuff as we can. But, you know, because we're a little bit more destination oriented, because we're a little bit bigger, you know, for the market size, you know, the local and regional stuff tends to do well, you know, kind of in the smaller venues downtown where it's just easier to kind of move in and out of. But yeah, somewhere between 270 and 300 shows a year there.
Now, I know you've looked at other venues for Higher Ground. Would that be in addition to the South Burlington location, or would it be to replace it?
It would be to replace it. So our goal right now is, you know, we've been working on a development project with Burton Snowboards on their campus down in the south end of Burlington.
Right.
You know, they've got a building down there that meets our needs. You know, like we have kind of specific needs. We need high ceilings. We need clear span. You know, we need, you know, a reasonable amount of parking. We need places where we can, you know, pull buses in, you know, because all the bands tour on buses. And so they've got a space that works. We've got a really fun vision for what that building that they've got on their campus can be. That would be us. It would be Burton's flagship retail store. Talent Skate Park is already in the building. They moved in during the pandemic or right before the pandemic. So there's an indoor skate park. And then we'd have, you know, a little food court with local food vendors in there as well. So it'd be a really fun complex where you've got a lot of complementary businesses with, you know, similar audiences and demographics. But everything is kind of complementary to one another.
And can you tell us where that stands right now, that facility? I know approvals and everything else have to be finalized, but any update on that?
Yeah, so we got unanimous approval from City Council. We got unanimous approval from the Design Review Board, the DRB, in Burlington. And now we're going through the Act 250 permit at the state level, and we're nearing the end of that and are optimistic.
All right. Let's talk. I hate to bring this up, but let's talk a little bit about 2020. When did Higher Ground shut down due to COVID, Alex?
March 13th. We decided to shutter and close the doors. That was, I think, a full 24 hours before the governor declared a state of emergency and forced everybody. So we kind of made the decision ahead of that. And I think over the course of the next day or two, we ended up postponing or relocating 127 shows.
Wow. Oh, my. Now, were there other Higher Ground Presents shows that you were able to put on during the course of the year?
Well, so the first 30 days of the pandemic, you know, we were, you know, well, I mean, first of all, like no one really knew how long it was going to last, right? I mean, there were expectations that, you know, this may only be a month or 6 weeks or 8 weeks, and that we might still be to hold on to our summer concert series that we do at Shelburne Museum and some of the stuff we do down on the waterfront in Burlington. You know, so we were sort of taking it one step at a time, but, you know, after 4 or 5 weeks, it became pretty apparent that, you know, most of 2020, if not all of 2020, was going to be a bust. So once we caught our breath, you know, and sort of reconciled with that reality, you know, we started to look around at what are the other things we could do, and we stayed very active during the pandemic, doing stuff that was more community oriented. None of it was revenue producing, but it was more just, you know, we had our full-time staff who was still on. They stayed on through the whole pandemic, and, you know, it was mostly what can we do to be useful, helpful, and, you know, kind of stay busy while we made it to the pandemic. So the first thing that happened, well, I guess the first thing that really happened was we started doing a live streaming series. Mm-hmm. So within a couple of days after closing, you know, we said, all right, listen, everyone's idle and at home and people are nervous, anxious, scared, information's moving, you know, at breakneck speed. So we handed our social medias every night, we handed our social media over to a different artist who was live streaming, you know, from their, you know, bedroom, their studio, their bathtub, you know, wherever they were in the pandemic and lockdown. We just said, you know, here are the keys to our social media. You know, we've got a fairly sizable social media presence in the state and in the region. And we said, great, have at it. So we did that. And I think that ran all the way through the middle of July without missing a night. So we ran that for whatever that is, April, May, June, I mean, 3.5 months. We did that. In the meantime, we also set up a drive-in concert experience at the Champlain Valley Expo. So, you know, we built a stage, we built a huge 80-foot truss wall that we hung a video screen off of, and we brought in a video crew, and we ended up booking I think 29 events there from the middle of June through the middle of October. You know, and we had Nico Case and Grace Potter, and we had Mount Joy and Camp and Goose and Twiddle. So we had a bunch of bands. We kind of just put it out there as an opportunity for bands to come play to audiences, you know, and it was all sort of COVID compliant and safe because you drove in your car and you could either hang out in your car and listen to it. You know, we were FM transmitting it. So you could either listen to it in your car or, you know, a lot of people, especially as they got more comfortable, you know, would just back their car in, open their hatchback, crank up their stereos and, you know, hang out in their kind of little pod in front of their car, you know, and watch a show. And it was, you know, it was what we had for that time, and it worked reasonably well. It's not something I was, you know, I'm excited about doing long term. I'm glad when we kind of shut the folder on the drive-in, but I think for trying to do something creative to keep people connected with live music and create opportunities for bands to play, you know, because I mean the bands, you know, we got to remember the bands are just as affected by this as the music venues. I mean, most bands make their money on the road. And so, you know, there was no touring anymore. So we were just trying to find ways to create opportunities for the bands, you know, to make a couple of bucks during the pandemic as well as connect with their audiences.
Let's take a moment to explain Higher Ground Presents, because this has become a real important part of what you do. What is it? Where do you host shows? And you know, how many, again, in a non-COVID year, do you do as Higher Ground Presents?
So Higher Ground Presents is just, you know, sort of our arm outside of the venue. The venue is Higher Ground. And then anytime we present a show, you know, outside of the club, we present it as Higher Ground Presents. And so that includes, oh, probably 15 shows a year that we do at the Flynn. We do the concert series at Shelburne Museum, which is, you know, anywhere between 8 and 12 shows a year at the Shelburne Museum, Concerts on the Green series. We do a handful of shows at what we call the Midway Lawn at the Champlain Valley Expo. And then, you know, during a normal year, we would do a couple of events down in Waterfront Park in downtown Burlington. We do the Grace Potter Festival, Grand Point North. We do the Twiddle Festival called Tumble Down. We sprinkle a couple of other shows on either side of Tumble Down. And then, you know, we do other shows in Plattsburgh or Barrie or Lebanon, New Hampshire. We do a big music festival with the band Wilco in Western Massachusetts called Solid Sound. So anytime we do something outside of the club, you know, we do it as Higher Ground Presents, and we just kind of go where it leads us. I mean, you mentioned Anais Mitchell, I think, on the intro. We produced Hadestown, which is now, you know, the award-winning Broadway mm-hmm. show. We produced that with Anais. I'm going to space on the date, but, you know, way back when it was still kind of in its, you know, formative stages, and we produced that across the state. So, you know, we did a couple of shows at the Barry Opera House. We went down to the Paramount Theater in Rutland. We went up to St. John's Barry, you know, so we moved that show all over the state and played it all over the place. And then I think we finished with two nights at Higher Ground.
I was at the Barry Opera House show. It was absolutely fantastic. Still one of my favorite nights here in Vermont. You started something this year called Backside 405. Tell us about that.
So Backside 405 is a little concert venue that's down at 405 Pine Street. So anyone who's been on Pine Street in downtown Burlington, it's the BCA building down on Pine Street across from Arts Riot and Daedalus next to the Multex building. There's kind of a grassy parking lot that's behind that building that sits right up on the edge of, you know, the old barge canal that's there. So it's this sort of little isolated oasis that's down there. And when things started to turn back on and we kind of could forecast what was likely to happen, this was end of April, beginning of May of this year, we were in hot pursuit of trying to get the Shelburne Museum series up and running, trying to get a few shows out at the Champlain Valley Expo, you know, trying to get some summer concert shows in. One of the things that occurred to me, because we knew we weren't going to open the venue, Higher Ground, the actual venue, until the fall, and most indoor venues weren't going to open until the fall. And so that's going to leave a lot of bands without opportunity. So we wanted to try to create a space where bands could have opportunity to come play. And again, you know, we were making these decisions and April and early May. So, you know, things have changed quite a bit since then. But, you know, in that moment, we were trying to think, okay, what is the safest way for us to kind of turn things back on and get people used to coming back out to see live music again? And so the idea was born to build a stage, leave it set up, and then do shows every Friday and Saturday down at Backside 405. So we've got, I think, we started on Memorial Day weekend. We're going to Labor Day weekend. We've got about 26 events. There's a few exceptions where we're not always there Friday and Saturday, but we're there most Fridays and Saturdays. We try to book a pretty wide range of musical styles so that, you know, everybody could have something that they'd be excited to come see. And then we also sold season passes, which is something we've never been able to do before. And those were a big success as well, because a lot of people bought, you know, the season passes were really affordably priced, and there's 26 events. And so a lot of people, especially people within the abutting communities, so the Five Sisters neighborhood, the Hill section, you know, bought them because, you know, they're going to come to five shows, you know, it made sense. And a lot of people we're seeing are just, they come down there.
Alex, we're going to have to wrap it up right there. I apologize, but out of time. It's so interesting. I do want to tell people, Shelburne Museum shows this weekend, Tedeschi Trucks sold out tonight, tomorrow, VSO with Francesca Blanchard, again, presented by Higher Ground. Alex Carruthers, thanks so much for being on today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Right. All right. Take care. All right. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, produced by Rachel Connors, Zoe Helena, and Brady Jalili. And Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.